I used to love my morning coffee until it stopped loving me back. The bloating, the discomfort, it just wasn't worth it anymore. Then I found Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's real coffee blended with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Now I get my morning ritual without the crash or the discomfort. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, you could win $100 cash or even get your entire order refunded. Head to everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
The upcoming presentation is a two-man power trip of wrestling podcast production.
Hello, welcome to the latest Business of the Business podcast. I'm your co-host, JP Ajampaj, the two-man power trip, of course. Joining me is the doctor himself, Mr. Lavi Margolin. Lavi, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing great, John. A special day and special episode as we peaked at 250. Now it should be easier down the hill to 500, and a very special guest to join us. Just a little bit of context. We've been warriors of the road, somewhat unexpectedly, this spring and summer.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
All over New York State, huge fan of his research, his books. Really one of the preeminent authors in this field and in any field, really covering nonfiction biographies, and quite intimidating as I work on my own look at sports and politics. But of course, without further ado, I'm very lucky to have this copy in advance. The author of Irresistible Force, Brian R. Solomon. Welcome back to the podcast, Brian.
I'm glad to be back. Thanks to both of you for having me. Yes, it's a very exciting time. The book is finally just about upon us. Officially comes out September 30th. So I'm very, very psyched to be here and in general.
Got my copy right here. It's a big one.
Oh,
it's a juicy one. I could knock somebody out. This is great, though. I mean, obviously a lot of research. So tell us about the process, the research, and putting this bad boy together. The life and times, the irresistible force, Gorilla Monsoon.
Yeah, you could definitely hurt somebody with that book. I mean, it can be used as a blunt object, a door stopper, a paperweight if you need one. No, but this one took me the longest of any of the books I've written. It's taken over my life for the last 3 years. And, you know, it was different from the Sheik book that I did, Blood and Fire, because he was such a mysterious guy that you had to, which was harder in a way, but there wasn't as much available and there were less people to be interviewed. And the family also chose not to be involved with that book. With this book, there was an overabundance of material. Gorilla gave lots of interviews in his lifetime to newspapers. He had a weekly column in a Philadelphia newspaper. you know, you get a view of a lot of his ideas. The family was involved this time, and they really pushed it to the next level. There were a lot of people willing to talk, a lot more information. So the research process was long. I did like 30 or 40 interviews. You know, I signed the contract to write the book in November of 2022. And I don't think I typed the first word until the summer of 2023. I mean, I wanted to be ready. That's kind of how I do these sort of nonfiction books or biographies. I like to have everything in place so that a story arc starts to form in my head of what kind of story to tell. So it's not just a list of things that happened. And then once I'm ready to write, I have an overarching idea in my head of, you know, what kind of book I want to write.
Man, what a topic, though. Gorilla Monsoon. I feel like, you know, guys, me and Lavi's age, or I guess you're probably right around that same age as well. Gorilla Monsoon, the greatest commentator maybe of our lifetime. I mean, a lot of people say Jim Ross, but I feel like we grew up with Gorilla in the WWF. So, man, there's so much meat on the bone. Like you said, then you throw in all the interviews and him being so forthright and stuff, right? I mean, there's just so much stuff on Gorilla out there and so much love for Gorilla.
Yeah, and of course, in a lot of his interviews, he's kayfabing a lot of things. You have to understand it's the era, right? And some things he's remembering not quite accurately. So you can't always take it as a gospel truth, but it does give you a sense of the man. And as far as him, how loved he was, it's very true. A lot of times with these books, the figures are complicated. Some people like them. Some people hate them. Some people want to bury them. Some people want to praise them. This was kind of universal praise. I mean, there was so much admiration that I actually devoted a spread in the beginning of the book just to a list of quotes from everyone, some of which made the book and some didn't in the body of the book, just everyone praising him that I spoke to, Tony Gurria, Jim Cornette, Johnny Rods, Davey O'Hannon, just like all the different people, Mario Savoldi, that were just overflowing with praise for him.
Did you ever consider writing a book about anybody else before you kind of, you know, when you finished Chic and then before you wrote Gorilla, was there anybody else on the table as far as writing a book?
I've thought about a few. I had in mind doing, and I may do it one day, doing an Antonino Rocca biography, with the idea being that he really and truly was pro wrestling's first high flyer. And, you know, he was a huge star in the 50s, but not shown a ton of respect from a lot of the boys. And he wound up, you could make an argument that the modern wrestling style is more influenced by him than by any other wrestler of his time. So that was kind of an appealing one. I may still do it. My dream is to do a Toots Mont biography. Toots Mont, who was a historical figure who had his fingers in so many pies over the years and played such a key part in wrestling history. But the thing with me is, I walk a fine line, and I know now how much work and time and effort goes into these kind of books and, you know, time away from your family and all this other stuff. And to be honest, I enjoy having as big a readership as possible. And I don't think, and there are a lot of guys that do this, and more power to them, I don't think I would have the level of dedication to be able to do a book that would only be read by, you know, a few hundred people that have a particular interest in this niche topic. So I have to look for things that are going to be wrestling history focused, but I also feel will have a wide appeal among fans. And, you know, I think I've done that with both of these, especially this one, because, you know, everyone knows who Gorilla Monsoon was. Even if you don't know about his wrestling career, it still gave me a chance to go back to the 1960s. And I'm writing about all this 60s wrestling, and I'm confident people are going to pick this book up because they love Gorilla Monsoon. So it was a very appealing topic for that reason.
It's a good point. You got to have that mass appeal, if you will, because then what's the point of wasting all the time on the subject?
Well, some people don't care. You know, some people, and I understand the attitude because I'm an adjunct professor and I'm an English major. And, you know, I get the idea of doing research and of doing scholarship and of, you know, digging up information for posterity, you know, and I really respect the people that do that. But I, you know, maybe I was spoiled by writing for WWE and having such a platform there. I want as many people to read my stuff as possible. So the people that do that, I think they're amazing, amazing. I just read Dan Murphy's book on Ed Don George, who was a world champion of the 1930s. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that needs to be done too. Those books have their place. I just, you know, I have my own approach to it and other people have theirs.
Gotcha. Makes sense. Yeah, you got to love the people that do it, because it's like, man, like some of these guys that don't get any love should be getting love, or yes, aren't getting enough love out there, and they should be getting more.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, there's a place for that. There's absolutely a place. I mean, I love, believe me, if I had my dream of, you know, whatever books to do, I would definitely be writing about a lot of different people. Because, you know, that are important, and it's important for their stories to be preserved. But, you know, I've also thought about doing one thing I really want to do maybe one day is a big coffee table art book looking back on wrestling magazines, like the way that they do with comic books, you know, those big, yep, beautiful, full color books. But those kind of books are expensive to produce. And yes, it's tough to sell a publisher on that, especially, again, if they're not sure if it's going to sell huge or not. Those books are, they cost a lot of money to make.
Yes. And we can't all be like Lavi and write about like the most famous guy in the world. You know what I mean? We can't all be like that.
Yeah, I don't want to. Although he gets mentioned, he's mentioned in the final end note of the book, because I talk about, you know, at the last chapter of the book is like the legacy chapter, like what happened to everybody kind of a chapter, you know, mm-hmm, like the end of Animal House or something. And I talk in there about the fate of Vince McMahon and everything that's happened to him. And so in the end notes, I mentioned how, you know, he was the federal investigation against him evaporated basically after Trump came into office, even though there's still litigation going on. But, you know, more power to you, Lavi. That's great. You know, you want to be a lightning rod, go for it.
Yes. No, it's so interesting the way you talked about choosing your subject matter, because I very much went through the same thing recently after finishing my doctoral degree, kind of like getting back into like, what am I going to research? And like, I was thinking like Martin the Blind Levy, you know, like, okay, but like, how much is there there? And then I was thinking about, and I might come back to this at some point, the year that Vince McMahon owned a minor league hockey team. So like that would be like fascinating. But I just didn't have enough content. So here, like once I settled on something, I was like, this is really juicy and it's timely in terms of, okay, Trump said there's going to be UFC on the White House lawn July 4th. It's a fascinating story. So that's what I'm going to do. So I 100% feel that.
Yeah. You know, there's a book that just came out. I met the author at Cauliflower Alley Club and he gave me a copy. He did a book on the life of Stan Frazier, who at the very end of his career, you know, did his probably most well-known thing. He became Uncle Elmer in the WWF with Hillbilly Jim. Yes. You know, look, this is not a book that's going to be number one on the New York Times bestseller list, but I started reading it. It's fascinating. I mean, like, you know, I'd like to soak up as much knowledge as I can. And we've been living in the golden age for wrestling books. It's so weird. No matter what happens to the publishing industry, wrestling books are just like this juggernaut that have been going for 25 plus years, ever since Mick Foley. You know, I mean, WWE per se doesn't do as many as they used to do, but I mean, ECW Press, you know, they're always confident that wrestling books are going to sell. And I'm very blessed to be in that subgenre.
I think one of the things, and outside of like the houses that you've worked with, like from big publishers to, you know, Premier, like ECW Press, I think one of the things that helps it to survive and sometimes thrive is that wrestling fans are pretty forgiving, meaning that we're used to watching wrestling on low speed internet, bad lighting, bad commentary. But if it's good, we'll forgive it. And everyone knows I've made some of my own mistakes in publishing, right, as I learned with formatting and whatever. And, you know, certain other genres, people will like dismiss it right away. But for wrestling fans, if there's a good story there, but the person didn't really know what they were doing exactly with editing and formatting, whatever, or like even how to distribute it, we're going to like find it. And if it's an interesting story, it will like be able to survive, if not thrive.
It's very true. And sometimes you even find some of these books that go out of print and people hunt them down like it's the Holy Grail. They'll pay hundreds of dollars. The Gary Hart biography, the Rocky Johnson one that got pulled by Crowbar Press. Like, people, these books become hunted, you know, sought after books. It's pretty crazy. But I'm my own worst critic about these things that you talk about, you know, mistakes in the books and stuff. Last night, maybe I shouldn't even be saying this, but last night I found out about a small mistake that I made in this book. And I found out because I asked Valerie Morella, Gorilla's daughter, about it, just out of curiosity, just to confirm. Meanwhile, there's nothing I could do about it. And I found out I actually had made a factual error, and I was just torturing myself all night. And she's, you know, trying to talk me down from the ledge. But I mean, it's a drop, you know, it's a small thing, but I want everything to be perfect.
Yeah. Don't torture yourself. Because you mentioned that Rocky Johnson book, there was a deal, I think, with like where Crowbar Press crossed over at the ECW Press. So I actually got a reviewer's copy.
I read it.
I live in a New York City two-bedroom apartment. When I was done, I put it down in recycling.
Well, that says it all, I guess.
So this is like one of those stories, like my mom threw out my like Amazing Fantasy 15 first appearance of Spider-Man. So that's my like.
She threw it away? Did you say she threw it away?
Oh, no, like not like, you know, older people have those stories. Like, oh, okay. You know, I had my comic books. I went away to camp. My mom threw it out. Like people from the 50s or like they threw out my favorite Mickey Mantle cards or whatever. So my story is that I did it to myself. I recycled my Rocky Johnson.
Apropos of nothing, my grandfather had a copy of Action Comics number one, first appearance of Superman, which came out when he was like 13 years old. His mom threw it away. So, you know, that's worth millions.
The comfort is that it did sell so many copies at the time. And if everyone did keep them, it really wouldn't have been worth that much. But not that much. So you had to have that story of people throwing them out for it to be so valuable today.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I'll forgive my great-grandmother. I think we lost John.
So John will be back, hopefully. But interestingly, and in terms of like the techniques and step by step process, I was actually learning along the way. For me, like it's hard to be patient sometimes to be like, okay, I have the information, I want to like put it out there and start writing. But you was this a process that you learned by to say like, okay, let me get all the interviews I can gather. The data, do the research and so on, and then I'll be able to put it together.
You know what? That's always been the way that I've worked, even going back to my first book, which was WWE Legends that I wrote while I was at WWE. And that's basically like a biographical dictionary of WWE stars of the territorial era. That was the idea. And with that book, I did, again, 6 months of interviews and research and talking to people before I could do anything. I just feel like it's the only way, especially with nonfiction. I've never written long-form fiction. I actually want to. I think I'd like to try doing a novel, maybe even next. I've written short stories and things. You definitely have to do research for fiction, but it's not as extensive. It's not as deep for most, especially if it's set in the present day. And it's something that you can research as you go along and fix certain details and things. With books like I do, you really have to understand the big picture before you start writing, because especially these biographies, you're writing someone else's story and it's a real story. And, you know, so you can't half-ass it. You can't just be like, I'll figure it out as I go along. And Blood and Fire, the Sheik book, was the first biography I ever did. And for me, I felt like the research was crucial, not just for collecting information, but like I said, for getting a sense of like, what is the story arc here? Because I take a lot of care in the actual craft of writing, not to get all pretentious and all that, but I am a professional writer. I'm not just a wrestling fan or historian. I'm a professional writer. I was writing stuff before I wrote about wrestling. If wrestling wasn't around, I'd still be writing and getting, you know, hopefully getting paid to do it. So I care about the craft of writing. And so when I do these books, I want it to have like beginning, middle, end. What are the themes? What is the big picture here? So it's not, like I said, just a catalog of things that happened to somebody. Like I pride myself in the actual style of the writing, getting in the right mood, you know, playing the right music and things while I'm working. It helps.
So, John, did you have any additional questions before we move into the
Yes. Yes. Sorry, I got cut off by internet. I don't know. Something's going on. Who the hell knows what's going on?
I thought maybe you were the exterminator that's supposed to be coming to my house. And so you had
that would have been, oh, man, that would have been an awesome swerve. The swerve, bro. That would have been an awesome swerve. Oh, my God. I was just curious, though. It's obviously, you know, Brett pretty well. Brett the Hitman Hart. He's doing the forward for the book. That's awesome. How did that go? Obviously, Gorilla was a huge fan of Brett and vice versa, I would assume.
Yeah, it was a whole chain of events. You know, I wasn't even really aware of the connection. I never put two and two together. Like, yeah, he used to talk about the Hart family all the time, Gorilla, on commentary. Yeah. He would, anytime Brett wrestled, even in tag teams, he would mention like his family, his parents, Calgary. He got over the dungeon thing. He may have even named it the dungeon, like from his commentary. I don't even think it was called that. But I didn't know the full connection. I am very good friends with a wrestling historian and collector called named Tom Burke, if you guys are familiar with him.
Yes.
He lives in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is only about an hour and a half from my house. So we see each other from time to time. And he was really good friends with Ross Hart, Brett's brother. In fact, Ross was staying at his house for a little while just because he has a wrestling museum in his home and wrestlers come to see it all the time. So he was staying with him. So Tom introduced me to Ross, and Ross was the one who started telling me about how much Brett loved Gorilla and I should talk to Brett for the book initially, just interview him for the book, which I did. But then I thought to myself, my goodness, what better person could I get to write? Because many of the people that were closest to Gorilla are gone, you know, and Vince McMahon isn't going to be doing this anytime soon for me. So I thought, like, my goodness, here is a wrestler, a really famous, successful wrestler that was very close with Gorilla, and that Gorilla helped him to become a star and helped get him over. It just seemed like a perfect fit. He was all about it. He took great care and wrote a beautiful forward, which is so intense. It's one of the best parts of the book.
Love that. So cool to get that. And obviously the Hitman is the man. So that's pretty cool. And the connection, you always notice he really put Brett over. The excellence of execution. Yeah. No, look at that move. You know, he really always kind of made Brett look like a star.
Yeah. What I learned was that Gorilla was a very big fan of the art and the craft of wrestling. He actually really enjoyed guys who could work. And he enjoyed watching a good match. You know, he was from that old school. It's like every generation kind of gets like that, though, where he had that attitude of like, well, you know, the guys today, they don't work as well as we used to work. And he did have some of that. And that's also why he would be critical sometimes of people on commentary. So when he saw people like Bob Orton Jr., Ricky Steamboat, Jim Brunzel, like these are guys he would put over all the time on commentary because he just loved watching them work. He could really appreciate it.
Very true. Let's hand over to Lobby. I know he's got a lot of good questions. He's chomping at the bit.
All right.
So, of course, I feel like our first portion was sort of like the inside the actor's studio, right, in terms of the process. So as this is the business of the business, I'd like to transition to a case study. Sometimes I call it a Harvard case study because it makes it sound more exciting, but it isn't necessarily so. I've been voraciously reading the book, but it's so large that I haven't gotten as far as I would like. So some of the beginning touches upon things you touched upon I've read, and then eventually following this, I'm going to read more about it. So I'm learning more as we go along. So today I'd like to center on the era just before Gorilla Monsoon came to New York, through the period that he sold his shares to Vince McMahon Jr. I know there's a lot there, so we'll sort of cover some areas
yeah, more. That's broadly. Like 20 years, you know.
But yes. More broadly than others. But yeah. One of the things that I've read about it before, no one probably has written about it as succinctly as you have, but it's still.
This episode brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Shifting a little money here, a little there, hoping it all works out? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can get a better budgeter and potentially lower your insurance bill too. You tell Progressive what you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll help find you options within your budget. Try it today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
Something where I'm still trying to grasp exactly what went on. So in the fifth, as I understand it, in the 50s into the early 60s, there was a wrestling war, which was basically centered in through Madison Square Garden, where a couple of different promoters sort of had the rights to the garden. Maybe they even switched off at certain points promoting that. So who were those players? What was the war? And sort of like, what was the result of all that?
Yeah, so New York was a battleground. New York City was. And by the time Gorilla got there in 63, though, it had kind of been mostly settled, but there was still little skirmishes going on. But Madison, the promoters of record at Madison Square Garden were two guys that were brothers. They were the Johnston brothers back in the day, like especially in the 50s. They promoted everything there, wrestling and everything else. So if you wanted to run something at the Garden, boxing, anything, the circus, you worked with the Johnston brothers. So in the beginning, a lot of the wrestling promoters had to work with the Johnston brothers. And for years in New York, it was Toots Mott and also Rudy Dusick, who was part of the Dusick Riot Squad, which was this wrestling family that went back to the 30s. And those two guys ran a lot of the wrestling in New York and all the outer boroughs and things. And the reason that Vince Sr. came into the picture, and they ran the Garden, was that Vince was running out of Washington, D.C. So he was not yet in New York, but he got plugged into a sweet deal because the national wrestling broadcasts that they were doing, which in those days was out of Chicago, they needed kind of like a summer replacement. And so Vince's Capital Wrestling from Washington got on the Dumont Network and was getting a lot of national play, and some of his talent were getting very popular in other areas. And so they started to become in demand in Chicago, and he would send them there to Fred Kohler. And in New York, it was happening. So guys like Toots Mott had to do business with Vince Sr. because they might have had the Garden, but he had a lot of the talent people wanted. So Vince Sr. started getting that foothold. There was also a couple of other guys. There was Jack Pfeffer, who was this very eccentric promoter who just traveled all over the country, basically trying to run wherever he could. And he had a partner, Pedro Martinez, who used to be partners with Toots Mott, but became his enemy. It's this very complicated thing. They were also trying to run the Garden. So you'd have this situation where if you look, and speaking of Crowbar Press, there's a great book on the history of wrestling at Madison Square Garden. And they give you the promoters of record for all of the shows. There's also the website, NY Pro Wrestling, great site. And you'll see like month to month, there's different promoters. So 57 or so, I think, is the first time that Vince Sr. runs a show at Madison Square Garden. But it's not until like 61 or so that he is the full-time promoter at Madison Square Garden. And he becomes business partners with Toots Mott. They go to work together. They become 50-50 partners in the Capital Wrestling Corporation. And they work with the Johnston brothers. Actually, I think there was one surviving one. And when the last Johnston brother died later in the 60s, then Vince McMahon really became the one true promoter of wrestling at Madison Square Garden. But there were other little mini wars going on when Gorilla was there and Bruno was there. There was a guy named Cola Quariani, who was another New York loyalist who tried to run opposition. Bruno went to work for him very naively and wound up getting blacklisted. So like these wars were still lingering even into the mid 60s.
So one of the other things that was really interesting, so many things, but one thing that stood out to me from the book as well was that sort of Bruno and Nature Boy, Buddy Rogers, sort of like they're being in and out with Vince Sr. Like at certain times, like one was in a good position, then they're out, then the other one came back. So can you talk about like those like sort of ever-changing relationships and even the friction between the two of them?
Sure. So the Capitol office had gotten behind Buddy Rogers, and they pushed him all the way to the NWA world title, which he won in 1961. But they also controlled him. So there was a lot of friction between the NWA and Capitol Wrestling. And that's partly why Capitol Wrestling broke away and became the Worldwide Wrestling Federation. and they had Buddy Rogers as their champion. Now, Bruno at that time hadn't really broken through in a main event capacity yet. He was a big attraction. He was a star. But he would claim in later years that Buddy was trying to keep him down and hold him down. And he was kind of sabotaged because, like I said, he went to work for the opposition thinking, hey, I'm an independent contractor. I can work for whoever I want. Vince Sr. wound up pulling some strings, getting him blacklisted. He was gone from the company for a while. He had to go up to Toronto to work, and he was doing great up there, getting over huge, getting in main events. Meanwhile, in New York, Vince Sr. was now having buyer's remorse with Buddy Rogers because Buddy Rogers had a great run, 61, 62. He was selling out the Garden every month, so much so that even Vince Jr., I remember, used to talk about Buddy in these glowing terms because of how he helped their business. But by early 63, his health was slipping. He wasn't reliable. He was also very political, a real locker room lawyer. He was being difficult, and I think he was even trying to steal the company out from under Vince. So Vince McMahon realized I need another star, and he wanted Bruno. And he brought Bruno back at the beginning of 63, and Bruno knew he had the leverage, like, to get whatever he wanted. So he said, look, if you want me back full-time, I want to be world's champion. I want to beat Buddy for the title, and I want to squash him. I want it to be an absolute trouncing. And by the way, Bruno would not admit this for many, many years because he wanted people to think it was a shoot because he didn't want his win to be undermined. But so they gave Bruno everything he wanted. And by the middle of 63, he was the man.
And talk about kayfabe, the picture I remember, at least hopefully I remember it correctly, was like Buddy Rogers kind of like clutching his chest like during the match, or it looked like that to me. So sure. I always thought it was a quick match because like, he wasn't, I know he wasn't healthy at certain points, but like that was why, like quickly get the belt off of him.
Right. So, it probably contributed because he was doing a lot of short matches at that time, or tag team matches and things, because he did have a heart issue going on, which Bruno also tried to downplay because that would also make his win, that would tarnish his win. But 48 seconds still is a little bit short even for him for that period. Like usually he'd have like little 5 minute, 6 minute matches. 48 seconds, that's a statement, you know?
So professional wrestling always had like ethnic wrestling and ethnic stars and so on, but I don't like even, I mean, I can look it up and probably guess, like, I don't even know exactly where Buddy Rogers' family roots are, but with Bruno Sammartino, it was very clear. And that was something I really enjoyed in the book. And I think something you really enjoyed is sort of like delving into your own Italian heritage and Italian American heritage. And like that really came through with like something like, okay, Brian is really enjoying this and it's coming through and it's such an enjoyable read. Yeah. So like, was Bruno sort of like the first, like, all in on an ethnic star? And on the other side, Gorilla, did he build the archetype of the monster heel that sort of defined New York for the next 60 years?
So ethnic stars per se had been around in wrestling already for generations by that point, even in New York, going back to like Jim Londos in the 20s and 30s, who was a hero, not just to Greek immigrants, but to all immigrants. And you even had Italian wrestlers, you know, Gino Garibaldi, Ilio Di Paolo. Rocca was an Italian transplanted to Argentina. So you had Latino, Italian fans who loved him. But with Gorilla, it was interesting because, and I'm glad you picked that up in the book because it's very true. I don't have the name, but I'm half Sicilian and I was raised by my Sicilian family mainly. And so I always identified myself as an Italian American. And the interesting thing to me about Gorilla or Gino is that he was also an Italian-American wrestler, but other than the first year or two of his career, he was not allowed to have that be his persona. So he got turned into Gorilla Monsoon, the Manchurian Giant. And so he was not allowed to be one of those ethnic stars. And in fact, a lot of people didn't even know he was Italian. And even in later years, there might be little hints here and there. He would drop certain things in prime time, say certain Italian things. But it wasn't something that he ever was allowed to publicly embrace. So one of the things with the book I really, truly made a conscious effort to do was to reclaim Gino Marella as an Italian American and to really stress his ancestry, his heritage. And I have to say, not that I want to be clear on this, and I am Italian by heritage. I'm not equating Italians with the mafia or organized crime, although the mafia were all Italians mainly. That doesn't mean that all Italians were in the mafia. I want to be clear on that. But my attitude towards writing the book in a lot of ways was the flavor I wanted to give it. But because, look, a lot of us have seen parallels between professional wrestling business, especially in the old days, and the mob. I'm not the first one to point those things out. There are other than just overt criminality and murder, right? But the way the businesses are run, the attitudes of secrecy, the territoriality, how everything, you know, there's a lot of parallels. So I wanted to write this book almost in the style of a mob book, like the kind of a book that Nicholas Pileggi would write, like the who wrote Wise Guy, the book that Goodfellas was based on, or the book Casino. I was actually like inspired by that style. That's even where I got the quotes at the beginning of every chapter, that idea. But one thing I would do, and I got into the habit of doing this, and I drove my wife crazy because she could hear it from downstairs. Whenever I sat down to write, almost through the whole process, I was playing in the background, back to back, the soundtrack albums for The Godfather and The Godfather 2, and just in rotation. And it really got me in the zone of the tone and the voice that I was trying to use for this book. And again, this isn't meant to be a slur or an insult to Gorilla or to the you know, Italians in wrestling. It's just that was the flavor I was going for of how the business in a lot of ways in his day was run not too differently.
Does any footage exist of Gorilla singing?
No. And I'm very sad about this because that was one of my great discoveries from interviews, was that he had a beautiful baritone singing voice. And he loved to sing Italian songs. He loved to sing Italian Neapolitan folk songs, Italian opera, and even, you know, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, that kind of stuff. And he would do it, you know, in the shower, in the locker room. He sang at people's weddings. He sang at his daughter's weddings, his sister's weddings. There was even a report that he supposedly sang at Giant Baba's wedding, which I would give anything in the world to have been able to witness. But I asked his daughter, I asked people, I said, is there any recording that you have? And she said, no. So that's a shame.
So Gorilla has this monster, quote unquote, run in, you know, Capitol. And then, you know, like many heels, as you define, he has to go out, but sort of the door is open for his return. So upon his return, how did he stick? Meaning, how did he burn out and then sort of like become a part of the fabric of things?
Yeah, and actually, this goes back to something you said before about him. He kind of really was the first monster heel in that territory, under Vince McMahon. And that was something that the WWF would become known for all through the years. These giant monster heels coming in to challenge the babyface champion. From Bruno through Hogan, really, it was the model, and a little bit even beyond that. But, you know, even till today, they still like to do that. But, you know, Gunther and Bronson Reed and things like that. Gorilla was the first, and especially because he was homegrown. He'd been around the business a few years, but he was not a known entity or a star. Gorilla Monsoon, the persona, made him a star. And so, but of course, in those days, the heels had limited runs. Because you'd come in, you'd get a lot of heat, you'd wrestle the top guys, you'd lose mostly because you're the bad guy, and then what do? You either drop down the card, right, or you have to go somewhere else and make people forget you or miss you and then come back. And so Gorilla's first run there was from mid-63 up until like late 65. And it was really hot. He got two tag team titles, and he had all the matches with Bruno. And then they said to him, look, because he had put down roots in New Jersey, or he was planning to do that. They said, look, we want to keep you. We know we want to keep you around, and you're really, you know, we like this, but we got to let you kind of go away for a little while. And so they sent him out to California, and he was there for a run, basically for a year and a half, almost 2 years. He wrestled a little bit in the Southern Cali territory, the LaBelles in Los Angeles, and he wrestled in the Northern Cali, San Francisco territory with Roy Shire. And he got married out there. His daughter was born out there. And then they brought him back. But that was always the plan, to bring him back. It was not a coincidence. They knew even then that they wanted to keep him around. And so he came back in early 67, and he got plugged right back in with Bruno again. They had another huge feud at that time. And then he, for like 2 years, he was being the monster heel all over again. And that's when in mid-69, they made the decision to cut him in, to actually make him a part owner, get him invested in the company. And it's exactly at that moment that they also turned him babyface, because that was also the fear of like, well, if you're a heel, you only have so much mileage, you're going to get stale, and you're going to have to drop down the card and just be a prelim guy. You don't want to do that. That would happen to some heels. So they made him a babyface so that way he could turn into like an attraction wrestler, almost like Andre before there was Andre. And that was the way that he stayed relevant as an in-ring performer, even while he was part of the office.
So getting a piece like that is really interesting, especially in comparison to Bruno, which I haven't gotten that far. So looking forward to that point. Like, was that something that could have been offered to Bruno? Was there still tensions and that was the reason that he didn't get it? Because I would think if anyone would get it and you want to ensure that he stays around for the next 12, 13 years, it would go to Bruno.
Absolutely. And it was offered to Bruno. They were going to do, you know, something similar like Jerry Lawler in Memphis, who owned a piece of Memphis. They would do that with a lot of guys. They would cut them in. Eddie Graham in Florida, and then he wound up running it when Cowboy Luttrell retired. Fritz Von Erich. I mean, that's how you keep your top guys around. So, but Bruno was, you know, Bruno and Vince McMahon Sr., they had a good business relationship, but it was rocky at times, and I would never call them friends. There was a little bit of holding each other at arm's length, and Bruno wanted everything to be very above boards, lawyers, accountants, go through everything, and that's just not how they did business, and they balked at it. They didn't want people snooping around the books and everything, and so Bruno said, I don't want to be involved in this. I don't want to be, you know, in business with you guys and have it be shady or not transparent. And so they were thinking of other people. Wild Red Berry was considered because he had been very loyal to the office. He was a wrestler who had become a manager who also worked for the office, but he was very old and he was looking to retire and get out. The reason it happened and that they were selling any of it was that Toots Mondt was retiring. Toots Mondt owned 50% of Capital, and in 1969, he decided to go home to St. Louis and retire. So what they wound up doing, and I think this was at Bruno's suggestion, it's in the book, they gave 25% so they split up Toots' shares. They gave 25% of the company to Phil Zacco, who had been their promoter of record all through New Jersey, Philadelphia. He ran the TV tapings. He'd been with them going back to the 50s. He was very loyal. So they gave him 25%, and they gave the other 25% to Gino, who was good friends with Bruno. Bruno had recommended him. He was a lifer. He was living full-time in New Jersey. He wasn't going anywhere or didn't want to. He was very smart, college educated, had a great head on his shoulders, and was also loved and respected by everybody in the locker room. So they really, and he was only 32 years old, and they thought, okay, this is the guy. And they made him not only 25% owner, he was vice president. He was listed as the vice president of the Capital Wrestling Corporation. And I also believe very strongly that he was supposed to be next in line to take over the company when Vince Sr. stepped down.
So fast forwarding to Junior kind of, you know, coming in and kind of hanging around, like, when did Gorilla learn that Junior had aspirations of taking over? When and how did they ask him to sell his shares, and sort of like, what was the reaction?
Well, you know, Vince Junior came into the fold around 1969, right around that time, as just sort of like a ring announcer, just helping around backstage. He was newly married, you know, needed money, not really a success on his own. At this point, he would have been like 24. And so they were trying to help him out, but he was not taken all that seriously through the 70s. Think about the way that promoters' sons were thought about in wrestling. You know, they were thought of, oh, you have to tolerate this guy because he's the boss's son, but he's not very bright and he's kind of a screw up. That was sort of the cliche. And that's how Vince Jr. was viewed. He was tolerated. But people didn't realize how serious he was about this and how aggressive he wanted to be. And so if you fast forward to the, and I'm sure he had this in mind for a couple of years at least, because he founded Cap, he founded Titan Sports in 1980. So he had to already have this in the back of his mind, even probably before he founded Titan Sports. So in 1982-ish, maybe late 81, Vince Sr. was thinking about getting out. Now, part of this, I think, was that he had pancreatic cancer. I don't think that he knew specifically what was wrong, but he knew something was very wrong and that he wasn't well. And also, he was just tired of it. Just he had a lot of money and just wanted to get out. So he was looking, he was not that old. He was maybe 65, 66, 67. He was certainly younger than Vince, you know, is today for sure. And he was looking to sell his 50%. So I put in the book how one of his first choices was Buddy Rogers, believe it or not, who had been kind of back in the fold with the company again, who Vince Sr. loved. But Buddy didn't have the money that was needed. It was a hefty price tag, and Buddy just couldn't get the money together. So then his thought was, okay, I'm going to take my 50% and I'm going to split it between my three partners. So by that point, you had Phil Zacco, you had Gorilla Monsoon, and you had Arnold Skolin, who had been cut in for 10%. Gorilla gave him 5, Zacco gave him 5. So you had three partners. Vince Sr. was going to sell to them. So basically, at that point, probably Gorilla would have been 40%, Zacco 40, Arnie 20. Now, Zacco was looking to retire, so he was just going to probably take his money and be a silent partner. So you could do the math there. That would have been the moment where Gorilla really got would get to be the man in charge. Pretty, you know, he would be the guy. And Vince Jr. swooped in and said, no, 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 don't do that. Don't do that. Sell it to me. And he convinced his dad. He was the first person to get on board, the most important person. Sell it to me. So Vince Sr. is thinking, okay, I'm going to sell you my 50%. You're going to, and you keep Gino and Phil and Arnie, you know, we keep them on board. It's your company now. And that's when Vince said, no, 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 that's not really what I want. I want all of it. I'm not just talking about your shares. I want to buy them out too. Now, listen, they were, you can imagine they were not initially thrilled about this because it was very uncertain. They didn't know if it was going to be a disaster and they'd lose everything, or if it was a huge success, they were still giving up part ownership in that huge success. So out of the three other partners, Gorilla was the obstacle. That was the thing, because Arnold Skolin would have gone along with whatever they wanted. He was a real company guy. He was not a super ambitious guy. He would have been happy. Zacco, like I said, very old, looking to retire. He didn't care. Give me my payout. I'll go home, which is what he did. Gorilla was the one who had the most to lose, and they had to really sweeten the deal. He was not happy at first. I taught even after the deal went down, and he got himself a really good deal. But even afterwards, he was very bitter, very pissed off. A lot of people that knew him said he was very uncharacteristically bitter and angry, even at TV and at the shows, just really discontented. And it took a while for him to sort of come around. He had a very good deal, and he made a lot of money from the good deal that he made. However, if he had been allowed to hold on to his 20%, he would have been infinitely more wealthy than he even became, and his family too. You know, he wanted to leave the shares to his family. That company, Vince sold it for $9 billion a couple of years ago. Do the math. 20% of that would have belonged to the Morellas, you know. So it was bittersweet, the whole process. It was not smooth sailing.
I think one thing, though, that is a positive, and Monsoon seemed to like refer to these things in commentary sometimes, sort of like he seemed to have some idea what was going on. Just all the scandal. I think from your.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Progressive loves to help people make smart choices. That's why they offer a tool called Auto Quote Explorer that allows you to compare your Progressive car insurance quote with rates from other companies. So you save time on the research and can enjoy savings when you choose the best rate for you. Give it a try after this episode at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Reporting and just what's known about Monsoon, like, he was a very credible member of his communities, from, you know, family ties, probably church, all that sort of thing. And like the way the company went through the scandals from the late 80s to the mid 90s and then, you know, pretty much gone from then, but then all the early deaths and everything like that, he was involved, but he didn't have to absorb that. None of that was put on him. I'm wondering if he was the most visible second in command, like if he would have had to manage things like that.
Oh, well, you're not wrong about that. I mean, he definitely would have had to get his hands a lot dirtier. He was protected. Like, the interesting thing that I find is in the 70s and early 80s, when he was part owner, a lot of what he would do would be the PR, essentially. He would talk to reporters. He would, you know, be featured in articles, and he would be, you know, putting over the company and the wrestling business, defending the wrestling business. He was very articulate and charismatic. So he had that public facing role. When it came down to all the dirty, dirty stuff with Vince and going on Donahue and Larry King and all the steroids and sex and drugs, he's nowhere to be seen at that time. And that's very clear to me that that's something that he didn't want to be put out there having to defend that. I mean, it's bad enough. He was privately disgusted by all of it, but remained loyal to the company and kept his mouth shut. But that would have been, I think, pushing him too far to put him out there having to have that public-facing role. I can't even imagine the idea of having, like, for example, like him on the Donahue show and then having to argue with people that were his colleagues, like Bruno Sammartino and superstar Graham. I mean, you could see that even he would have said, listen, do not put me in that position. This is not my mess. So he had to navigate some tough waters there, like you say, in the 80s, early 90s, you know, and he survived. A lot of people take issue with some of it, and I understand, you know, it's probably the biggest kind of like personal flaws in the book that I address, the fact that he did nothing, you know, he looked the other way like everyone else did, and he would sometimes even make jokes about it on the air when it was not something that was publicly known. These were inside jokes. And I address all of that, and I don't, you know, people will say I'm an apologist and I'm letting him off the hook for everything, but I think there were a lot of very legitimate reasons for all of that, honestly.
Yeah, so absolutely fascinating. I think there's so many things that I've learned already, and I've read, you know, so many of the other wonderful works and so on that covered some of these time periods, but like, there's just things I'm just like, my mind is blown already. So before turning it over to John, I want to talk about something that's not business, that's certainly family, and just wondering how you in the process addressed it. To me, like, having seen friends going through it and that sort of thing, the loss of a child, I think, is, you know, there is, we have in my tradition, we say, like, there are no words, right? Like, there's no words of comfort or anything like that. So as we know, of course, Gorilla son, Joey Morella, right, passed away tragically in a car accident as the referee in WWF at the time, on his way to the next town. How, you know, do you approach that with the family, even though it was so many years ago? It's known, but it's, you know, such an emotionally difficult thing, like, as compared to other information. Do you build trust first and then sort of bring it up later? How did you do that?
It was something that you could tell they were still hurting from all these years later. I mean, when I started working on the book, Maureen, Gino's wife, was still with us. She passed away earlier this year, but she gave me several interviews for the book and gave me access to photos and was very supportive. In fact, she had even been reading the manuscript at the time, like, she didn't get to finish it. But so it was tough. And in fact, she was hesitant in the beginning to participate in the book because it just still hurt so much. And she didn't want to harm Joey's name and legacy. Like, they made very clear to me, and it is a fact, I checked it, that it was important to them that the accident that killed him had nothing to do with drinking or drugs. I know it's small consolation, obviously, but his demons are not what got him in the end. It was just the grueling road schedule, because Joey did have some substance abuse issues, but he had beaten those, sadly, ironically, by that point. And that was not the cause. So like they were very protective of Joey. So I wanted to be very respectful. And I think with Gorilla, like, yeah, it destroyed his life. He was never the same. He lived for five more years and he was just a shell of himself. And I think he gave up on himself. And he loved Joey. You know, Joey was, he had adopted Joey and Joey's sister Sharon. They were Maureen's children from her previous marriage. And they were very little when Maureen married Gino. When you know, her first husband had abandoned the family when she was pregnant with Joey. So when she met Gino, Joey was a baby and Sharon was like 3 years old or something. So he was the only father they knew. When they got married, they had one daughter together, biologically, Valerie. But Gino adopted. So he was not a stepfather. He adopted Joey and Sharon. He was their father legally.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. You chose to hit play on this podcast today. Smart choice. Progressive loves to help people make smart choices. That's why they offer a tool called Auto Quote Explorer that allows you to compare your Progressive car insurance quote with rates from other companies. So you save time on the research and can enjoy savings when you choose the best rate for you. Give it a try after this episode at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Adopted. So, you know, he loved Joey like he was his own biological son. There was no difference. But I think the other thing that killed him was he never wanted Joey to be involved in the business. He was trying to keep him out of it. In fact, he's the one that discouraged him from being a wrestler. And like, look, just be a referee at least. And, you know, he had other hopes and plans for Joey because he knew the dangers of the wrestling business. And this was like his worst fear coming true. And there was also, I think, the layer to it of, you know, I was the one, by coming into Maureen's life, I changed Joey's life. You know, Joey was her son. And now because I stepped into his life and brought him into this business that I was in before I even knew him, now he's dead, you know? So I think there was a little bit of guilt as well.
Chills. I think, you know, so many fascinating stories. And I want you to pick up the book first. And then when the audiobook comes out, which you've been working very hard on for the last few weeks, to listen as well. But let me turn over to John.
Is there any lessons to be learned from the Savannah Bananas pro wrestling? What do you think about that?
Well, I guess you're referring to the fact that I went to see the Savannah Bananas last week with my friends and my son, and I had never even heard of them before. In fact, what I found out about them because we did an article on them in Pro Wrestling Illustrated, because there's a lot of indie wrestlers that are involved with the with this baseball league. And it was a lot of fun to me. It's interesting because, excuse me, I went into it not quite knowing what it was. I know it's not Major League Baseball. I know they have a lot of crazy rules and they do dances in between at bats and things. So I went in thinking, assuming this was like the Harlem Globetrotters of baseball. Like for those that know, when you see the Harlem Globetrotters play the Washington Generals, like you're not watching a basketball game. It's yeah. just a performance. It's like going to the circus. They're climbing ladders and slam dunking. And the Generals are just like falling all over themselves like idiots. This was not quite that. It's hard to categorize. Me and my friend were debating the whole time. It looks like they are genuinely playing at least their version of baseball with their amended rules. They're maybe not trying the hardest. I don't think they particularly care so much who wins and loses. It's more for fun. But in wrestling terms, I would not term it a total work. It seemed like maybe there were times where they were sort of finagling certain things, like maybe counting something out when it shouldn't have been out, or, you know, a guy not catching a ball that he could have caught. But it wasn't an overt work like the Harlem Globetrotters. But as a wrestling fan, it was very interesting to watch and a lot of fun.
Yeah, very little bit of shades of pro wrestling in there, for sure. Yeah. But give us one last big push for the Irresistible Force.
Okay, so Irresistible Force, The Life and Times of Gorilla Monsoon, it's officially out on September 30th. You can get it in print and digital wherever books are sold, all the major chains, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Books A Million. I know most people probably will use Amazon. Even your local bookstore, if they don't have it in, if you have a local bookstore, they will order it. You just have to ask. It's really anywhere. If you're in Canada, I would suggest even too, you can buy it from directly from ECW Press because they are a Canadian company. In America, not so much because of the shipping, and it really adds a lot to the price. So you'd probably be better off buying it from another outlet, but it's going to be available everywhere. The audiobook, as you guys said, is not ready yet. I finished recording it. We're going to do like last minute pickups and edits next week. And I've been told that it should be available on Audible and places like that by next month. That seems like a crazy turnaround for me, but they assure me that that's probably what's going to happen. So I will have a specific date and I'll let everybody know.
Now, as far as your social media, where can everybody find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Brian R. Solomon. And I've got, my podcast, Shut Up and Wrestle with Brian R. Solomon. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. There's a Facebook group for it as well, Shut Up and Wrestle with Brian R. Solomon. And what else? Well, I guess those are the broad strokes. That's where people can find me.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Two Man Power Trip. How about you, Lavi? What are your plugs?
Yeah, follow me on X at Lavi Marg, LaviMarg. And on LinkedIn, we're so close to 150 members of the Business of the Business LinkedIn group. Really the only group of its kind.
All right. Thank you, Brian. Thank you, everybody out there, for listening. See you right back here next week for a little Business of the Business. We'll see you next week, folks. This has been a John Paz Power Trip production in conjunction with the Two Man Power Trip of Wrestling. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Two Man Power Trip. You can check us out on Facebook. You can subscribe on YouTube. You can go to patreon.com/TMPTEmpire to become a patron. And also check out the website TMPTEmpire.com and buy a shirt at ProWrestlingTees.com. Two Man Power Trip, where the power lies. Brother. Three, two, one. Happy New Year from our friends over at Manscaped. The ball has officially dropped, but that doesn't mean you have to drop the ball on your balls in 2023. Whether you had a New Year's kiss or not, the leaders in below-the-waist grooming have you covered for your much-needed resolution of bringing sexy back. Join the 7 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped. With our exclusive offer, go to manscaped.com and use the promo code BIZ, B-I-Z, for 20% off and free shipping. Let us have a toast for a new year, new you, and a new you with no pubes. If you really want to make 2023 the year to remember, make sure to try out Manscaped's wet goods as well. This includes the ultra premium body wash, 2-in-1 shampoo, and body deodorant. These products are absolute perfect for follow up after your New Year's gym sessions. Cheers to new balls in 2023. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code BIZ at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use the promo code BIZ, B-I-Z. Time to feel sexy and free this 2023 with Manscaped.